to the podcast, where we talk about all the things that are hidden in the shadows.
This is Isaac, and on this bonus episode, I'm joined by Stephen and Leslie Shaw, authors of Who They Are and What Are They Up To, a book all about aliens, encounters, and stuff like that, along with being alien enthusiasts, along associated with the paranormal at the same time. They're all experiences I guarantee are going to interest us, that's for sure. How are you guys doing?
We're good. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Fla 4, huh?
Oh, your shirt.
Your shirt, Fla 4.
Oh, yeah. No, I've been Nordic faith for the last couple of years, and my mom got me this shirt because of the Father's Day shirt, so it's Father.
Yeah. How cool is that? That's great.
Very clever. Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember listening to you guys on Tommy's podcast, Let's Get Freaky, and you guys actually, you know, asked to come on us, and I was like, oh yeah, I know who they are. Let's bring them on, because they had a very interesting theories and stories and things that they learned when it comes to alien activity and abductions and, you know, the stuff different around them. So I was like, I don't really, well, we do dabble with alien stuff. I think we'll have a Alien Part 6 episode if we do another one. So we have done alien episodes in the past, but, you know, it's always nice to talk about aliens other than paranormal investigating paranormal stuff. So, but it seems you were telling me beforehand you guys have been involved with the paranormal before.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. For mostly my entire life, and going back 3 generations in my family bloodline, actually really 4 family bloodlines, but primarily the Newmans, Shaws, Rose, and a little bit of the Griffiths from starting from Germany, going into England, and then into United States.
Do you go from family generations of psychics?
Yes, pretty much.
Very much so.
At least on one side of the family.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Newmans down to the Rose, and then myself as a Shaw.
They were automatic writers for 3 generations. In fact, 4 generations now that Stephen's sister has picked it up as well.
And my sister has decided to finally start to use it because, you know, she had her, you know, she didn't want to, she was a born-again Christian for quite a number of years, and she didn't want to be involved in what she knew and what we knew about the family.
Like, this isn't happening.
So, but the talent is there. I have the talent too, if I want to use it, but I do not want to use it. I just, I
the
would
automatic
rather not.
Writing.
I do other things besides that.
Right. So.
Well, my knowledge of psychic mediums, because my wife, my co-host Megan, she is a very talented psychic medium. Automatic writing is like one of the many gifts that you can, or possible doing, along with, you know, clairvoyance, clairaudience, and ability to hear or feel the emotions, being empathic and stuff like that. So you're saying your mm-hmm. family focused strictly on the automatic writing side of the psychic?
Oh, no, there's clairaudience and clairvoyance. And I've had basically precog happen a couple times.
And astral projection.
Oh, astral projection is easy. Like that. That's not a big deal. It's just, you know, for me, it's, you know, because I taught Tai Chi and I did Tai Chi for many, many years, it really helped to enhance a lot of those abilities that we as humans do have inherent. We have the ability to do things like, you know, astral projection, to do, you know, a paranormal kind of type stuff, you know, like hear things. Like, for instance, I used to be able to hear radio stations, like a talk show host, 2 talk show hosts. When I would like relax in the afternoon in my mid-20s after working a hard day, I would just relax in my room, and it would be as if I was listening to a talk show with 2 DJs and with music in the background, and there was no music on the house. And this is the thing that would be a common thing for me to do. Yeah. You know, I could repeat it. I could repeat it every time. So, but you know, this whole thing, as far as I grew up from the age of 3, knowing that we had this family spirit guy called Old Glegley that would help out people in the family and visit certain people in the family in times of need. And I just grew up just knowing that. So when I was at the age of 3, I would be visited from time to time in the middle of the night by this little entity that would be about the size of a cat that I couldn't see visually, but would jump on my chest and my stomach, just kind of playing with me. And I thought, well, this is kind of fun. You know, it's not menacing. And I just accepted it. So then, about the age of 9, I had this experience where I was sleeping in the top of a bunk bed. My brother, who's 6 years younger than me, was sleeping on the bottom, and I was awakened by this really strange sound that I didn't recognize. And I knew it wasn't the family dog, but I was curious. So I got out of the bed, again, middle of the night, and I walked down the hallway, and my heart was pounding. I was definitely scared. I was literally, in adrenal mode, as I call it, and I just was really not expecting to. I did not know what I was going to see. And before I got around the corner, I just black out, and next thing I know, I'm back in bed about 2 or 3 hours later, with no knowledge of what happened.
Yes, we found this to be the case with the family in general, where they'd have these bizarre experiences, see something completely strange, and be frightened by it, and yet suddenly black out and wake up 3 hours later, tucked into bed, or with no memory of what happened in between. And we have since, in our research, discovered this is the signature for the abduction phenomenon. And in Philip's case,
My younger brother.
they tend to come in clusters, these experiences. And one time he had a cluster of three events in 3 nights. He was sleeping in his bedroom at their Central California home in Sonora,
Yeah,
California.
we were building a house, so it
So
was
they,
they, you know,
yeah, the
yeah.
family was in two locations at the same time, going back and forth. And he was at the northern house, and he woke up with these bright white lights shining into his room. And the his room right outside it had a drop off of about 25 feet down to a creek, and then across from there was a mountain with a forested mountain. So there's no lights in the distance, no homes, no road or anything.
Yeah, very foresty area.
And he's staring at these lights, trying to figure out what he's looking at age 16, I believe he was.
Yes, he was
And
16.
suddenly he blacks out. And then the very next night, he hears a weird scrabbling sound. He's lying in bed and he reaches down to pet what he thinks is a cat, and something grabs his arm instead.
A hand grabbed his wrist,
And
as you described it.
he blacked out again. And then the third night, he saw a tall gray alien in his room, 6 foot tall one, the taller ones. And he said he stared at it for just a moment. It stared back at him, and then the next thing he knew, it blacked out again.
He blacked out, yeah.
So this is why we think it's the alien abduction phenomenon that plagued the whole family. But it took us a while to figure that out. We had to start comparing notes with each other, because Steve has not been able to break through. We've tried some hypnotic regression, but we haven't been able to break through the memory block yet.
It's a difficult thing with hypnotic regression. I
Yeah.
have been hypnotized very effectively once when I was not on my 19th birthday,
So we know he can be
yeah,
hypnotized,
but
but
giving up that, I don't, I don't want to have false memories implanted in me, and also you have to trust a person. They also have to believe you in the first place,
yes, with
and you have to build,
the
and you
therapist
have to build a po you have to
that
build a
believed you.
pony, you have to build pony up the money, to
Yeah.
be able to have it done. And I would know, for me, like I said, recently, I said that I much rather just have them meet with me and just say, hey, this is what we want of you and your family. We're not really your family spirit guide. We're basically your alien handlers, and we've been taking care and watching over your family for at least 3 generations. But just come clean with me. Just let me know. I would rather not have to go through hypnotic regression, but it's
Yeah, but
just,
they're not forthcoming
yeah,
very.
they're not very forthcoming. So
Yes.
anyway.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I was my best guess with Oblegley is not he's not a family spirit guide. It sounds like an alien portraying itself as something else in order to
Yes.
make you guys feel safe. Because as my understanding and my own spiritual journeys and stuff like that, spirit guides are associated to one individual person, not a group of people. Now,
Right.
it might follow you through many of your lives, but that person will change vessels throughout your time, but that's past life stuff. But
Yes, yes.
it sounded like it was following your family specifically. Did you guys ever figure out why it wanted your family specifically?
That's a really, really good question. And I wanted to kind of highlight, as far as this Oglegly character manifests, used to I thought Oglegly was, I was told Oglegly was a very tall, slender black man from Tunisia that wore a red hat, a red fez. And in fact, my uncle, who's passed, who told me about an experience that he had. He was he was Griffith's. He buried my mom's older sister, and he allegedly saved his life in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, just after World War II. But allegedly manifested as this tall, black, slender, about six and a half feet tall, foot tall, a black man. So when I met allegedly when I was 18, I manifested as a tall, blue-white entity, tall, skinny, and not menacing, but paralyzed me. And as a result of that meeting in the morning of January at the Fallbrook House, all the coins that were in my pocket and the right-hand side of my pocket were magnetized. So 6 hours later, when I went to go to get lunch for my dad and I, because we're cabinet makers, and I just reached into my pocket and I pulled out the coins that were in my pocket, and these are all standard American coins, and they were all magnetized. I could pick up the coins. My dad could pick up the coins. It didn't matter from the edge, from the face. They were all still magnetized. And it was only because, again, this was like a cluster of five events, five nights in a row, that stuff happened, and each one got a little more intense. My sister experienced it. My dad, I definitely experienced it. I was like the target, I think, the main target. I was harassed more than anybody was in the family. My dad saw some things, and my sister, and you know, have you ever read any of Dionne Fortune's work, Psychic Self-Defense? She's a famous psychic from Great Britain from like the turn of the century. She wrote that book, Psychic Self-Defense.
I've heard a few things. My wife actually read a few things on him. We mostly get our learnings from Dolores Cannon, but other ancient ways of protecting. But yeah.
It was interesting because I had a friend way, way back in 1981 that did some research, and he said, you should read this book, because one night I had given my dad this book to read by Paramahansa Yogananda about metaphysical meditations. And I just gave it to him casually. He said, Dad, you should read some of this stuff. And about a half an hour later, he came into my room with this perplexed look on his face, saying, Stephen, I'm hearing a silver bell. And I said, okay, Dad. So I walked into the living room, and sure enough, there was the sound of a silver bell being rung inside the 2x4 wall by the fireplace. And we were just looking at each other and said, that's not possible. It can't be a squirrel. I mean, they don't have silver bells. So we got my sister, who was a born-again Christian this time and 13 years old. She didn't want to have anything to do with this kind of stuff, but she said, where's that silver bell coming from?
She could hear it.
And so, like, we banged on the wall, looked up the chimney and the flue, and it went on for a good 10 or 15 minutes, and then it just quit. Now, I later was told that apparently according to Dionne Fortune, that a spirit or an entity that is not quite strong enough to be able to manifest itself visually will manifest with the sound of a silver bell. It's in her book, Psychic Self-Defense. The funny thing was, is that the house that Wesley was talking about that we were building 350 miles away in California, my mom, we talked to her that the next day in the morning. My mom said that, you know, she said, Jeffrey, you know, the phone rang. I heard this bell ringing, and I picked up the phone, and there was this voice of a man on the other line saying, I am the invisible Ambichi, or something like that. And my brother said, Stephen, the phone didn't ring, but mom did pick up the phone. And so they were experiencing the same phenomena at the same time that we were experiencing. So all five of us experienced this silver bell phenomena. And it was just like, you know, for a long time, I thought, oh, it's some type of a paranormal thing. That it's the family spirit guide. But when you have coins in your pocket magnetized, and it's a blue white light energy being paralyzes your body and says,
yeah, whisper in your ear.
And it's just like, you know, and fills the whole room up with this intense blue light, white light. I decided when I hit about 30, I said, I've got to really start to do some research into this, because it's just not adding up. You know, so there is some type of a connection or a crossover, as far as I'm concerned, between the alien phenomena and the paranormal.
And our research shows that it tends to be, at least in the United States, most of our research was done in the United States. Most of the people who are abducted here are Caucasian. And there are a disproportionate number of green-eyed people taken, and a disproportionate number of Rh negatives people are taken. And the Basque population in Europe, they have the highest rate of Rh negative in their bloodlines. And we're not sure. So Basque people are disproportionately taken as well. We're not sure if they're after the Rh factor more and therefore they're taking more Basques, or they're after Basques and therefore getting more Rh negatives. We're not sure which criteria.
Yeah, the chicken or the egg thing, yeah.
And a lot of the people we've interviewed are claimed to be psychic people. So it seems like that's part of it too. And we know they communicate with their abductees telepathically. And we believe that telepathy is a human power or ability that has kind of atrophied in us over time and can be opened up again and can be utilized if you do the chakra opening work and the kundalini raising work. Stephen was a Tai Chi teacher very young. He mastered it very young. And as you know, Tai Chi is a moving meditation, and mm-hmm. just doing Tai Chi regularly and all the martial arts he was doing made, you know, opened his chakras a lot. And he had a lot of these psychic abilities very young in life. Go ahead and tell him.
Oh yeah. Well, I already had them. I kind of inherited them from my mom's side of the family, but I always knew there was a lot more out there. And the nice thing about Tai Chi was that I had a very good teacher, and he taught me to, you know, read the Tai Chi classics, read what these old masters had done, read how you stimulate the Chi and what Chi means and about the chakra type stuff. And sure enough, when I did the work and I actually practiced Tai Chi and Qigong, literally you do start to feel the Chi. It's like it starts out like this warm, warm water sensation coming up your arms into your hands. And then you're just filled with this energy that comes through the bones, and then you just literally, it's effortless. You literally, it's almost like the room becomes filled with energy and you can actually feel it. So this is like something Tai Chi just enhanced my natural abilities. I already had this. I just didn't know what it meant until I had a teacher that kind of helped me to direct, you know, me in my life. And it was very, very helpful. For sure. I mean, I became an acupuncturist, state licensed acupuncturist for 20 years, and I treated dogs, cats, and humans. You know, it just really, you know, gave me a good pathway in life, quite frankly.
And when we were researching the abduction phenomenon, at first we thought, like many people thought, that the aliens are just interested in us scientifically. They just want a few samples, no big deal. They take you, take their samples and put you back. And they want a cross-section of humanity. They want from people from all different races and walks of life. But this turned out not to be what was really happening. When we started researching it, we discovered that what happens is that the aliens find a specific bloodline that they want, a specific line of genetics or DNA that they're after.
Material, yeah.
And once they find them, they put trackers in them. And they take them regularly. Every few months, they would abduct them again and again and again and again through their whole lives. And then their children would start being taken, and then their grandchildren would start being taken. It seems to me that they're after a particular line of DNA. And once they find it, they prey on that for generations. And that's what we think is going on with his family.
You probably have some questions at this point, I bet.
No, I was just curious in the idea that people, alien enthusiasts, the ones I've talked to at least, they say there's more than one alien race here that's either trying to rule us, trying to help us, or trying to harvest us. And there's different alien species. Which alien species would be the one that essentially is bothering or saying harvesting, doing this kind of particular choice with just the white race of people in America specifically? And the stranger situation, the question is, why just Caucasians? Why just white people? Why not any other race? Is there something different that Caucasians have versus everyone else, other than the lack of melanin in their skin?
Well, our theory is quite different from a lot of people's beliefs in this matter. We don't think that these are alien races coming from all different solar systems and planets. We think instead that the Nordic aliens are a branch of the human race that split away from us thousands and thousands of years ago and have mutated since then. As you know, probably from talking to people, the Nordic aliens are almost indistinguishable from regular human beings. Except they look like Nordics, tall Swedes, say. They're white-haired and blue-eyed and
Is that where
tall.
they got the name?
I'm sorry?
Is that where
By
they got the
the name, yeah, the Nordic aliens, I think so. And also, Bird described them as having Nordic accents or
Germanic, Germanic
Germanic
accents. Actually,
accents.
that's what he said.
He said Germanic or Nordic accents,
Okay.
exactly.
All right.
So, and then we think these other races, so to speak, are the evidence of the Nordics' genetic modification programs.
Yes,
We think
exactly.
they utilize genetic modification just like we use any tool. And let's say they need underwater beings to do a bunch of work down in underwater bases. They might breed the reptilians, or if they need super strength, they might breed Bigfoots. And if they need
More dispassionate type of handlers like the Greys.
like the Greys, we think they have taken an underground race of humanity. Because when I look at a gray alien, as far as the rare pictures or the drawings of them, what I see is a human being. They're closer to us than anything else on our planet. They walk upright like us. They have deltoids, clavicles, elbows, everything bending the same way. At a distance, when people see them, they think they're humans. They move like we do.
Like large children or young children.
And they stand perfectly upright, unlike anything else on our planet. And they look like they've been underground for a long time, like they've gotten bigger eyes and bigger pupils and grayer, paler skin, and they don't need hair anymore to protect them. So we don't see these as coming from, this race from Alpha Centauri and this race from the Pleiades and that race from the so and all over the place.
Plus, that explains how they can breed with us so easily, too.
Right.
Yeah, they're very, our closest relative right now that we know of on this planet is the bonobo chimp, which is about 99% the same as us, but that 1% makes a huge
Yeah, but
difference.
and even though they're so close to us genetically, they're nothing like us. They have nothing like the kind of thinking power that we have. They don't stand perfectly upright. When they're frightened, they run away on all fours and take to the trees. They're really quite different than us, and we have a lot more in common with, say, the grays or the reptilians
And
or the
yeah, and plus human beings,
insectoids, you know.
we know that human beings make terrible slaves. We just are we are a rebellious bunch, and if you want to have a slave race or servants, whatever, you certainly would want to have ones that are just, if you have the ability, like we're playing around with CRISPR technology right now and AI. We're playing around with curing certain types of blindness and bringing back the woolly mammoth. So we already know how to do this stuff because the human genome is only four base pairs, so it's really pretty easy when they figure it out. So they can cut and paste. That's really what CRISPR is. So if you have a head start of a few thousand years, probably playing with genetics would be just like playing with building blocks for us.
So
Easy.
we tried to look into the past and to determine when our races could have separated. And what we looked at specifically was the extinction events of 13,000 years ago and the Great Flood. One of my backgrounds I didn't mention, but I studied ancient art history in college. That was my minor. And one of the books I read during that time period was Fraser's work about all the different flood myths worldwide. In the 1700s, this guy named Fraser wrote this book, and he had isolated 500 separate cultures around the world that had a flood myth in their past. And since then, there have been a lot more discovered. So there's more like 1,200
Yeah,
separate.
Hancock found some more gray man from
And
back in the
Childress
90s.
has done some work on it.
Yeah.
And it's evident that a flood really happened. A worldwide shared experience really did occur. And The extinction events of 13,000 years ago is where I started focusing my research. And sure enough, about 3 decades ago, they discovered nanodiamonds in the soil of 13,000 years ago up around the Labrador Sea,
In the Northern Hemisphere.
the North American hemisphere, but the northern east side of it. And these nanodiamonds form in no other way except a celestial impact of some kind. And at first, I was looking at the Hiawatha crater, but that turns out to have been a 48 million year old event. But since then, they've discovered the Younger Dryas comet remains
Lake Superior.
in Lake Superior area, which would have been when it hit 13,000 years
Yeah,
ago, it would have
actually,
been part of the ice sheet.
right, exactly 12,850 years ago.
Yeah, that one is dated to the right time period. And it wiped out the Clovis people, the woolly mammoth, the mastodon, the dire wolf, the saber-toothed cat, the American camel, the American horse, the stilt bear, a lot of animals just wiped out all at the
Yeah,
same time.
and some were able to hang on for a
Yeah,
little bit longer, but
the mammoth ground
not for very
sloth
long.
hung on to life for about 3,000 more years, but also eventually died out. And we think that this event may have been the catalyst for our race to separate and into two. And half of the, or some of the race escaped the cataclysm, and with their technology and their knowledge intact and their spiritual, upbringing, their, everything wasn't
Your
lost. Their
civilization.
civilization, in fact, entire civilization wasn't lost. They saved it. But we on the surface, we who were left behind on the surface, we were just almost wiped out to a man.
Down to about 10,000 individuals. There's a genetic bottleneck that happened 13,000 years ago, where the basically we the 8 billion people on the planet right now have
All regenerated from
regenerated from 10,000,
10,000
which is
individuals.
not that diverse, really.
Right. So that's one of the reasons that even though we're a very large quantity population, we are not actually genetically very diverse at all. And this is wise because we were almost wiped out. And so these beings that separated away from us, they are 13,000 years at least more advanced than we are because they kept their technology, but we got shoved back into the Stone Age and had to start over, basically.
The tale of the haves and the have-nots.
So we think it was kind of a deep impact thing, like the movie, right? The president says, "Oh, well, we're going to send astronauts to blow up the asteroid, and if that works, great. But if it doesn't, we have Plan B." And Plan B was to dig these arcs underground, deep underground, and put our brightest and best people down there. And all our technology would go with them, and our culture would go with them, and we wouldn't lose ourselves. Humanity would survive.
Yeah, one thing that really kind of led us to this belief is that in all these flood myths, there's one commonality is that they all had foreknowledge and forewarning.
Yeah.
So if you have foreknowledge and forewarning of a year or two, you have to have at least a partially developed space program.
And advanced astronomy, certainly.
Exactly.
In fact, we think that humanity may have been a spacefaring race before this asteroid hit, and some of the, I mean, a comet rather, it was the Younger Dryas comet. We think that some of them escaped into space, and that's what these bases on Mars are. That's what these bases and structures on the moon are, and on
Dark side, yeah.
Phobos, the F F moon, one of the moons of Mars, has a tower structure on it that is obviously not natural. It's I want to say man-made, or and man-made, because if it's us that built it from prior to the impact, that would mean that they were an advanced race, possibly a little more advanced than we are now when the astro I mean the comet struck and shoved all the rest of us back into the Stone Age, where we all had to start over again. And a lot of these flood myths, they have an after story that are remarkably the same from one
Yes.
to the next to the next to the next, is that after the flood, waters receded and there were some scattered survivors. These scattered survivors just reverted back to barbarism and cannibalism. And a lot of these myths talk about a god coming to them, teaching them civilization again, animal husbandry, crops, growing crops, math, architecture. All of these skills were given back to us. And I think this is the evidence that these people that survived it kind of took pity on us poor slobs on the surface and returned as these pantheons of gods. They returned to Egypt as Osiris and his family, right? They returned to Greece, and we have Zeus and his group, you know, and then
you got Babylon,
and then the Indus Valley in India, they have their pantheon of gods, and the Sumerians have their pantheon
China,
of gods,
and Huangdi, Neijing,
and we think that they came back to the surface, but because they were so far advanced ahead of us, they just came back as gods. But gods that can have sex with us and make babies, you know, to this day, they're still doing
That's
it.
Right. That's right.
Like, you know, a lot of these abduction phenomena where they're actually got this bizarre breeding program with us where they're making hybrid beings, right? And I thought at first when I was researching, I was going to find a lot of in vitro fertilization techniques or, you know, that where they're genetically modifying the babies that they're impregnating into the women. But no, they're just having sex with us and creating babies. And they, in order to be able to do that, they have to be us.
Or somewhat kind of version of us.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. They have to be close enough for sure.
The oldest flood story that I know of, because I research a little bit in histories, so I've been searching for answers associated with my ability, and my listeners know exactly what I'm talking about. But you guys, like I said, we'll talk about it afterwards because I know it'd be too long to talk about now. But one of the things I've learned about with the oldest story so far told is what we know about the Mesopotamians and ancient Sumerians and stuff right. like that. As far as the only recorded, oldest recorded history we have. And they talk about the flood story with the Epic of Gilgamesh and stuff like that.
Right.
So it tells me that that if wasn't the original, or at least that's the oldest story we have, and everything right. after took kind of, you know, hey, that story I heard before, let's copy it and paste yes. it to our kind of thing, kind of influencing the idea. Right, that story could have spread out from a certain amount of time, but that story, the city, I forgot what the name of the city was that Gilgamesh was the king over for a
city
period of time.
Ur? Was it
yeah,
Ur?
That's the one. Yeah. Which is now modern day Iran or Iraq, somewhere in between that area. But that tracks with genealogist studies where the human race started, which we've all started in Africa. And we right. kind of spread out through that continent, going further and further out from each other. Hence why, you know, we get the different races, because we all started at one, we all kind of spread out, and of course our bodies naturally adapt to our surroundings. So, you know,
right.
our use pigmentation for less sun, you lose melanin in certain parts of the world, we spread out across, and then
right.
that's kind of we started. For 10,000 people starting in Africa, that like, makes sense of how we all kind of started there, and then we started spreading out over thousands and thousands of years. But I don't chalk aliens, or particularly as gods, aliens' entire influence with humanity, saying that's the only reason why we are so we were technology advanced, how we were able to build pyramids, have all the technology and intelligence we have. Could they have played a major part? Major? I don't know. Minor? Probably. But there are civilizations that existed all across the world that were able, capable of high mathematics, say the Aztecs, for example.
Right.
Their intelligence, their way of understanding how, you know, everything worked and how they built their own pyramids was on rival with the Greeks, but yet they never get any kind of credit for it because they were conquered. But when it comes to the Greeks and stuff like that, how they understood architecture, even the Egyptians, which right. we still debate to this day, who built the pyramids? Was it people? Was it aliens? To say that we had major technology in the past, yeah, that makes sense. Same yes. goes for, did they, ancient Egyptians, before the actual Egyptians, maybe between the Mesopotamian and the Egyptian era, did they have a certain form of technology that we lost that maybe involved sound or psychic abilities?
Yes, certainly it's possible. The Zachariah Sitchin, who we get a lot of our sorcerer, the Anunnaki and the Sumerian information comes from his work and his translations mostly.
And a couple other sources.
There's a couple other sources too. But Sitchin makes an excellent argument in his book, The 12th Planet, that the Egyptian pyramids, the Giza Plateau, were built by the Sumerian god, Anunnaki god, Enki, who was the great builder of the early Sumerian peoples. The ziggurats were his work, and supposedly he had put locks on the Nile, actual damming locks on the Nile at some point, which have since been destroyed, of course. But he was supposed to be their great builder, their great thinker, their greatest scientist. And after the flood, according to Sitchin, after the flood and all of the works of the Sumerians were destroyed by the waters, they decided to move one of their the triangles of their triangulation for a space flight. In order to guide a ship down from space, you need to have a triangulation of beacons to cross over towards each other. And according to Sitchin, in about the year 10,000, Enki built the Giza Plateau, all of the pyramids, with their, you know, highly superior knowledge that they didn't lose when the flood happened. And that's why it's such a superior, all the following pyramids that came later were like just mankind trying to emulate the gods and their works at Giza. But Giza is above and beyond what anything that these primitive people were supposed to have been able to build. They are attributing the pyramids to a copper tool society, not even bronze. And the Great Pyramid is lined with rose quartz, a seven on the Mohs scale. And if you can take a copper tool or a bronze tool for that matter and whack it on rose quartz all day, and you'll just wreck the tool. It's way too hard for these people to have been able to shape it, and not just shape it with absolute machine precision. It's ridiculous that they're attributing this to this this culture of copper tool using people. It's just absurd.
No.
And you know, the way they talk about the pyramids being built, there's 2.3 million blocks in the Great Pyramid alone. You would have had to put, in the 20 years they claim that it took them to build it, you would have had to put a block in place every 14 seconds for it to actually be able to build it in this 20-year period of time. And we're talking about people, and they say, oh yeah, they rolled them up these ramps with logs. There's no hardwoods in Egypt. These are all softwoods. There's no way it would have just crushed the logs of the era.
No tailings pile either.
And where's the ramp? Where did the ramp go? Tailings pile. And it's not there. So it's madness to think that. And you know, like I said, when I was studying ancient art history, and this was the theory that they were proposing, it just kept not making any sense. And then I read Sitchin's work, and he attributed it to the more advanced peoples prior to the cataclysm. And then it suddenly made sense, because they had the technology. They had the ability.
And they didn't lose it, yes.
Right.
And your experiences, Stephen, and then your study of ancient histories in the past and everything's adding up, is these both your guys' experiences together is what led you guys to write the book?
Yeah, we're a good team that way. I'm a journalist and so a writer, and Stephen is our primary experiencer of the phenomenon.
I did dabble in writing. I took college level courses. I did write a short story, but she is definitely the more qualified to write than me.
But he wrote his family's histories into our book as well, so that's why we're co-writers, and we're both co-researchers. We've done, frequently I would come up with something. I'd say, Steve, I need this particular subject researched. You're on it.
I've been searching for the vast majority of my life to get my own personal answers. So for me, it's been like
Right.
closer to a lifelong journey for me. It's like I say, it's not something I talk to my friends with when I was in elementary school or even junior high, because they think either that I was nuts, or that I was living in a haunted
Or
house,
weird, yeah.
or I was just, my family was weird or something like that. My family came from wartime England as it was, so we were always kind of a little bit, let me put this, conservative, and we didn't have a lot of friends over. So, we were very much like, family first type of situation,
And Stephen has, he was a retired, he's a retired acupuncturist now. He was for 20 years in the medical Chinese medicine field. And he has a much more scientific
I know the brain very,
education.
I know the brain very well.
He has a more scientific education than I do. And I needed that extra knowledge for all of the geology, trying to understand the comet and the asteroid impacts and the effects on the planet. And also on the changes to the human brain that we surmise happened roughly 300,000 years ago. The Anunnaki claim, this is, it's not like Sitchin and us making this stuff up, right? He actually
Well,
translated the Sumerian tablets to find that the Anunnaki possibly uplifted humanity, the human race, from Homo erectus to Homo sapien about 300,000 years ago. And Stephen's research showed that this actually may have really happened.
according to Jason Martell at one of the recent disclosure events I went to, he's involved in a lot of the more of the scientific part of what's been going on. And it looks like, at least that from what we can find now, the neocortex, which is the most recent part of the human brain of Homo sapiens sapien, it appears that that there was tampering done about 300,000 years ago in the area close to Broca's brain, which is the speech centers. And so it looks like there was a cut and paste, kind of like what we do, except this cut and paste was done on the inside of the neocortex, which is about the thickness of cardboard. Okay, but that separates us with the frontal cortex and the neocortex and Broca's brain. It separates us from Homo sapien, make us Homo sapiens sapien, gives us the ability to be able to like read blueprints. You cannot make the pyramid unless you can have language, and you have to be able to write down on a blueprint, and you have to have a plan, mathematics, architects, and you have to have the knowledge of astronomy, how to put it in the four cardinal points. None of these things could have been done without advanced mathematics and language. That's what a lot of people don't get. And
Right.
it infuriates me when I hear Egyptologists keep on saying that this was done just with logs and elephants and a long ramp. For what purpose? For what friggin' purpose?
Yeah. It would have taken a million years to build it that way if it were possible at
Yeah, they
all.
were
Yeah.
building it during when they still had a rainy season too.
Yeah.
They're, when the Nile was still flooding, they didn't have a 24/7, 365 building season. I mean, you can see that with the erosion patterns on the Sphinx.
Right.
So it's like, no, it wasn't built in 20 years, and Khufu had nothing to do with it, as far as I'm concerned.
And also, 10,000 years ago, we were just entering the precession time, astronomical time of Leo, which makes sense why you would put a Sphinx out in front of your big pyramid complex, right? And we're just now entering the age of Aquarius, right? And precession takes thousands of years to go through, but it looks like the time of Leo is 10,000 years ago when Sitchin claims that Enki built the Giza Plateau, and
Post flood, yes.
yes,
So, what do
and
you guys?
they're not tombs. They're not tombs.
I was about to ask that. What do you guys believe, in your own personal belief, or maybe theorize, or what you guys have found that the pyramids were built for?
Oh, I'm sure they serve multiple purposes, as well as power generation, communication, maybe even
Beacons.
beacons, or maybe even like especially the sarcophagus in the king's chamber.
It may have been a uplifting tool itself, and it might expand
They
consciousness.
found a lot of what are called monoatomic earth elements all outside of the these little white particles that are they're monoatomic, they're single atom earth elements, and they can be generated. In fact, I have a friend that did body harmony for years, and one of the things when a group of people get together and get into certain types of meditation, they start to form these little white fine powders on their bodies, and they actually form monoatomic earth elements,
They
which
surround the sarcophagus.
right, and the sarcophagus was surrounded with monoatomic earth elements.
But one thing we like is the Christopher Dunn wrote this fascinating book called The Pyramid Power Plant. And we think that this actually makes a lot of sense. First of all, he has some really good evidence for it. One of the little shafts that go down into the, I forget the name of the lowest chamber down there. I think it's the King's Chamber. And these two shafts,
Two shafts.
one comes from one side, one comes from the other side. One's got,
Hydrated zinc.
I need the science person here, Mark.
One day they found hydrated zinc in one of the
One of the
canals,
shafts.
one of the shafts, and the other one was basically muriatic acid or hydrochloric acid.
And if you
And
mix these two things together, like we think they did inside this enclosed chamber,
like a hot box.
and you cause
A chemical.
any kind of excitement to it, it creates hydrogen gas. And we think that it rose up into the upper chamber, the big chamber. And Christopher Dunn said all you would need is some devices in there to excite the molecules further. And he said you can actually create X-rays with this
Yeah, microwave technology,
microwave
basically.
technology. And he thought, Sitchin believes that they were using the pyramid as a beacon, a space beacon, and that they had one on top of Mount Ararat, another on top of Mount, what's the one,
Sinai?
the Sinai, Mount Sinai,
Yeah.
or Mount Catherine, which was right next to that one. And then the other one, they needed a third triangulation for
Which was
to be able to.
the Great Pyramid?
And the third wheel, the third hub of the triangle, was in the middle of nowhere, a big flat area that didn't have any mountains, right? So he said they built this the pyramid as a
It's a
third
machine.
beacon for triangulating down from space.
As part of its usages,
Interesting. Now, I know you guys study aliens as being in the physical, but have you ever studied aliens in idea of interdimensional?
Right.
We have mixed feelings on that, from the
Right.
standpoint that yes, we do believe that that there is a paranormal aspect, and I do know there's different vibrational frequencies. Like when I talked earlier about my being able to listen to different radio stations and kind of stuff without a
Yes.
radio station being on. The brain can be tuned differently. Right now we're at 40 brain wave cycles per second because we're in beta wave of frequency right now, because we're on visual media. But when, like with Tai Chi, you basically bring down your brainwave frequencies are between about 8 and 14 cycles per second, kind of into an alpha state. And then below that, you've got your theta, then you got your deltas that get down into 2 and 4 cycles, which means that different aspects of your brain are tuned differently. That's why sound and vibration and chanting are so integral and important to the development of the complete human being and the complete human brain. So literally, we can tune ourselves in, and that makes us more receptive to the idea of interdimensional beings, or communicating with, let's say, like instead of listening to like radio station 97.1, maybe some of us can listen to like 98 or 97.6. It's just basically tuning a little different, like the shamans could do. They can hear. They're not hearing voices, they're hearing different communication. But it's all that we have.
But this
We
is
have
more
that.
of a psychic phenomenon or the psychic abilities of human beings, not so much interdimensional travel, say. And one of the things we like about our theories, or at least I like, is that it doesn't require any theoretical physics to be true. It doesn't require faster than light travel. It doesn't require wormholes. It doesn't require interdimensional travel. It doesn't require time travel. It's all physics that we can understand right now. In the ancient times, these beings that were traveling around our planet in rocket ships, they were maybe the Anunnaki. We weren't there. We can't be sure, but we think that they built these different cities all over the world with the same kind of pyramids prior to the comet impact. So when you go to a new location, the first thing you do is you build a pyramid quickly. That's now your power source. And from that power source, you can set up the rest of your society on do all the rest of your building. And maybe that is why there's these pyramids that look like the same hand constructed them all around the world. And we think that they set up, like I say, a power plant and possibly a communication tool. That's another thing you can do with microwave technology is communicate back and forth all around the world with these. So they may be communication tools, they may be beacons, and they may be power sources, according to
or all three.
Dunn. Yeah. And there was this work by Mark Carlotto that really inspired me. And Sitchin also claims that the Anunnaki themselves were in Peru and the Americas and
Sacsayhuaman
and the Mexico area. And it seems like the similar hand building the stuff, these megalithic structures. That's another thing. It's like, why? You're a primitive Bronze Age person. Why would you build with 200 ton blocks of andesite? Sacsayhuaman is the biggest rocks in their wall are 200 tons. And they are andesite, which is almost as hard as granite. It's in fact, it is as hard as the
it
granite.
Is. It's
like
seven,
a seven on
seven
the
Mohs
scale as well. Again, they wouldn't have been able to shape it with their bronze tools at all.
And
people
that we've met that have actually been to Sacsayhuaman, which is above the tree line, they say you wouldn't believe what it looks like if you're actually there physically.
It's
overwhelming. And you look at it from above, it actually looks like a sluicing station.
Just ran a bunch of water through it, it would actually separate out heavy metals. If you ran like a river through it or large bodies of water. And it looked like it's somewhat Sacsayhuaman. There may have been a giant water tower. There's a round area at the top that looks like it might have been the bottom couple of bricks of a giant water tower.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. But yeah, as far as communication interdimensionals, I believe that we have the ability and we probably are being contacted by, you know, I think that's part of the whole paranormal thing is literally like almost an interdimensional, not necessarily coming from a galaxy far, far away, but there's different frequencies and different sensitivities. And, you know, some people pick up on it more than others. That's all.
And Carlotto's work is fascinating. I don't know if you've read any of Mark Carlotto's books, but he's a global positioning, satellite positioning expert. That's his main focus is
that's his field.
Yeah, and what he noticed from day one of looking at the alignment of, say, Teotihuacan, the pyramids at Teotihuacan, the base of the structures do not align with the cardinal points like the pyramids do. They instead align to the cardinal points when the North Pole was in a different location.
At the Hudson Bay, right?
In the East Hudson Bay. When the North Pole was there, according to Hapgood, the guy with the lithospheric shift theory, and we know that the North Pole has shifted around several times, and it would have been in the East Hudson Bay between 12 and 18,000 years ago. And if it was underneath everything, you know, the
foundation,
the foundations of the structures, they align with the cardinal points right at that the old pole location,
the previous pole location.
So
yes.
He thinks, Carlotto thinks, that the foundations of these cities were built more than 12,000 years ago, when they would have aligned perfectly to the
The
East
cardinal
Hudson
points of
Bay.
that time.
And all of the cities in Mexico around Teotihuacan, all of the pyramid structures, all of them line right up with the cardinal points where they were 12 to 18,000 years ago. And we think the Younger Dryas comet, when it struck, actually caused this lithospheric shift. Remember, between 12 and 18,000 years ago, this comet hit, and 12,850 years ago, to be exact. And we believe it caused a lithospheric shift at the same time. And that would have made it even the cataclysm even worse. It would have added to this height of the tsunamis, and literally oceans would have been ripped from
It
their
would have
beds,
been
and
more apocalyptic for sure.
even more so.
Yeah.
And we know that the layer of soil above the Younger Dryas boundary is, I mean, the Younger Dryas boundary is this 13,000 to 12,000 year old layer of soil right after the impact that shows drastic climate upheavals. And that would explain why the surface persons that had survived were thrown back into the Stone Age so effectively. It's because the climate upheavals would have made growing crops impossible. We would have been forced back into a hunter-gatherer type of societies.
Now, what's interesting is that the Aborigines have been around in Australia for a long, long time, and they're the comet hit in the northern hemisphere, and it's quite possible that the Aborigines and more in the southern hemisphere escaped some of the major deleterious effects of the impact. But yes, the Aborigines go back, I think, like 40 or 50,000 years or something like that.
One of the few histories that goes
Yeah.
back really far.
Goes, it's one of the oldest ones. So yeah, so people did escape, but they talk about their star brothers. It's funny. In fact, the American Indians we've talked to, as we've gone along talking to people, they have a totally different viewpoint. They look at them as being star brothers or star friends or the ant people, and they look at them from the standpoint of not being like afraid like a lot of people. They see the aliens as being literally,
Friends and brothers, yeah.
the Star Brothers.
The reason I ask, because being a paranormal investigator for 3 years now and having my ability for the last 3 years and stuff like that, everything I've learned with doing these investigations, I've never had much experience with aliens. Granted, I've been out in the woods because the only place really I can investigate around here in certain parks and stuff like that. But my only real investigation, that was my only time. My most profound alien experience, which I think you guys might find interesting. And I want to hear your opinion since you guys have so much knowledge when surrounding it. So there's a park near where we live, called Northeast Creek Park. It's a giant open field, about the size of a football field, with a trail on the left side that goes semicircle all the way around, covered in trees. And we kind of had a lot of experiences while we were there, finding things in the woods, getting things to the spirit box. Everything you can think of. But one of our second times there, we had an experience that made us think possibly there could be alien activity here. And for everyone listening in this episode, most likely I'll explain that in our next episode. We talk about with the Collins Elite, which I'm sure you guys probably have your own opinions on them. But the experience that we had is that I had a member of my team who very elder psychic, he had a long history with it. I called him the voice of the dead because when we did the Estes method, there was no one better. So he blindfolded himself, put the headphones on, put the spirit box on, sat in the field and started tuning in. And I asked those who were here last that weren't here from this world, we want to communicate with you. And we just got, over typical ghost stuff coming through. And then we heard static. Or sorry, Mike heard static in a very computerized tones. And then he said, this is him speaking, but they're speaking through him. What do you want to know? I said, were you the ones here the other night ago? Yes. Where are you from? Not here. What world are you from? Not world, interdimensional. And I said, do you know who I am? And they said, yes, Ashwakanatanka. I said, what is your purpose here? To observe, to watch. And then it was something I guess Mike might have thought. And then he heard them say, oh, the source, pray to the source. It was not like they're telling me to do it. It was almost like a, you know, like a, this is said and that's said right after. Like the source, oh, praise the source. Kind of like that kind of reaction. At least that's how he said it. And then it went static again. And then it went back to dead. The cereal box was dead. And then me and my wife both witnessed on the opposite side of the field, so about 100 yards, in the tree line, this white ball of light shoot up that was so bright that we thought was a flare, like someone fired a flare up in the air. And it hovered there for a second and then fired off in the sky faster than I've ever seen before.
That sounds like a UFO activity for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the first and last time we've had any kind of UFO experience anywhere we investigated.
When we...
I just wanted to jump in here. My sister is currently using a spirit box and FLIR cameras and things such as that. And she's in communication with my dead parents, my dead brother, and she contacts them on a fairly regular basis in Great Britain. So she may be a good person to talk about the spirit box thing, and maybe in the future.
Well, and I can't speak to ghosts so much, but we've been researching this phenomenon, the alien abduction phenomenon, for many years. And one thing we discovered is that when Stephen and I married, we started doing, he was already able to astral project, and he had already done a lot of chakra opening work.
Yeah.
But I had not. And so I began doing Tai Chi with him, and we started meditating and chanting work that's meant to open the chakras. And as I did this work, I was slowly able to gain the ability to astral project. And Stephen also was able, his ability increased, and he was able to astral project more. But one thing we discovered was that whenever I went astral, I had nothing bad happened. I had fun with it. I would go scuba diving without a scuba suit, or I would go to Egypt and see the pyramids. But whenever Stephen did it, and I believe it's because of this connection to his alien handler, it seemed like as soon as the veil came down into the astral realm, they were there waiting for him. They make these connections with humans. And I think a lot of the voices that people are hearing through spiritualism are possibly them. And they are waiting for us kind of psychically just on this other side of the veil. And the fact that you saw one of these, you say it was a round white light sphere kind of thing?
It was bright. Me and my wife both thought it was like someone in the woods firing up a flare gun. That's how bright mm-hmm. it was. But it only mm-hmm. went up so far. Like it shot up out of the woods, floated for like maybe 1 to 2 seconds. One, we saw, be able to look, hey, you see that? And then poof, to the sky.
That's the same one we saw. My first UFO... Steven's seen like three UFOs in addition to all the other activity he's had.
I've seen five, but we've
but,
seen...
I mean, three yeah. before we saw right. two together. And so he's seen a total of five, and I've just seen the two. But the first one I saw was a white ball of light, very bright, hovering above, you know, in front of us. We were driving. I was driving and looking through the windshield, and I thought it might be at first a plane, but it didn't have the blinky lights like a plane would. And it was just a white ball of light that got brighter and brighter and brighter. And then it shot away at 20,000-ish miles an hour and was gone over the northern horizon in less than a quarter of a second.
It left like a little trail behind it, too. Like, yeah. Almost like a Star Trek effect.
And like a line stretched out and the back of the line caught up to it. And within a quarter of a second, wasn't even a whole half second. During the last hearings on the congressional floor last summer, when the two pilots were describing the UFOs they encounter, one of them, Fravor, no, I'm sorry, it was Graves. Graves was the one on the East Coast flying with the Red Rippers out of Oceania. And he said that these UFOs that dog them all over the time, all the time, are these clear glass spheres about 15 feet in diameter. And inside they have a cube, like a black cube or a gray, dark gray cube. And when these craft are hovering, these cubes tend to spin very quickly. And that's why you'll see them up in the sky. Sometimes they'll flicker. If you're looking at UFOs online, you'll see this flickering I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I think I wanted to interject here as far as like the last unidentified object that we saw together really kind of reminds me of what you were talking about, what you saw in the field there. What I saw with Leslie, it was almost like a greeting. It's almost like these entities knew that we had just moved to this house we moved to. And it was just literally within like a week after we actually moved here from where we were before. We just went out. We have a very, very small backyard. I mean, it's like the area of the sky that we can see from our backyard is like is minuscule. Okay. So we happened to go out there just to enjoy the evening. And there was this, like you're describing, this intense white, kind of almost shimmery, but almost like some sparks were coming off of it. And it was just like right there. And kind of like watching us, and it started doing these weird movements,
impossible movements,
soundless, of course, and then just took off to the north
again.
It was almost like saying, hey,
miles an hour.
It was almost like, to me, I always interpreted it from the standpoint that it was like saying, yes, we know where you've moved to, and we'll be keeping tabs on you. And we weren't the only ones who saw it. There was another couple that were living on the street where we still live, and they actually saw it, a younger couple, they saw it too at the same time.
I wanted to ask you, are you anywhere near Brown Mountain?
I'm in North Carolina, but Brown Mountain's on the opposite side of the state.
Opposite side of the state?
Yeah.
Brown Mountain is, we believe, one of these alien... they tend to do this. They tend to hollow out mountains. And then that mountain and create their underground civilizations there. And then these mountains have all this UFO activity constantly around them. Like Shasta is a good one. Mount Hayes.
Mount Kailash.
Denali, Brown Mountain is another, Mussini in Italy.
The Hudson Valley.
And we don't know which mountain they've hollowed out in the Hudson Valley, but of course the Hudson Valley is famous for its UFO activity. And like you said, Mount Kailash. We think there's a lot of these civilizations built into these mountains underground and where they would have been safe from the cataclysm. If you want to go underground to survive a tsunami, you don't want to do it at low ground, right? Because the tsunami could end up leaving a lake on top of you, you know? But if you go into a volcano, that an extinct volcano has a throat that goes almost all the way to the Earth's core.
To the mantle, actually.
And a lot of the, through the crust, I mean.
Yes, to the mantle.
And then a lot of these mountains have these enormous caverns, empty caverns inside of them because of the lava flows, lava tubes. You know, sometimes they're in long tubes and sometimes they open up into giant caverns. So if you wanted to transport a population to safety and you only have a limited amount of time to create this underground city.
And if you have the technology to basically... finish the work, like make the tubes much bigger, you know, make the caverns huge.
Right.
And also, it's a very, you know, I used to be a cave explorer and, you know, wild cave exploring, which is kind of dangerous. And believe me, I can tell you that, you know, it's climate control down there. It's, you've got geothermal, you've got water, there's a lot of things. It's a lot safer. You know, the billionaires these days, they're doing the same thing. They're basically, putting hundreds of millions of dollars into building their own fortresses underground, you know, with complete moats and lakes and the whole bit, you know, to ride out a cataclysm. It's just, you know, again, it's the haves and the have nots, you know, but.
So I'm not sure if they have interdimensional abilities, maybe they do. We know they come through portals a lot. I see it as more like they're just able to negate matter and walk through, because we see in a lot of the data that we've collected where people describe almost like a duck blind up on the mountain. It, like a hole opens up and all this light spills out of it and UFOs fly in and out of it. And then the hole closes back up again.
Yeah, the Modoc Indians around Shasta talk about that quite a bit.
And also the... Jicarilla
The
people
Jicarillas.
in New
And
Mexico,
the
I believe.
Hopis talk about the
I hope I'm not butchering that pronunciation, but
They're the different ones, like the Hopis talk about the ant people, you know.
right, and
So.
they and the in this the Archuleta Mesa, that's one of these places where they've seen the like a the door opens, light spills all the way out of the thing, and then it closes, and the UFOs fly in and out of it, and then it closes back up again. So are they using interdimensional travel to do this kind of portal work through solid matter? We can't be sure, but we don't think so. At least I don't think so. How do you think? What do you think about
I'll
it?
remain mum on that.
I know. I'm going out on a limb there, I think.
Which is not experience, and the fact that they gave me that kind of information, if it was aliens I was speaking to begin with, but that light that I saw, that kind of sealed it that it might have been, because I've never seen that brightness of lights. I mean, I've seen
Yes.
orbs, I've seen ghost lights and stuff like that, and they're very dim, but this caught my attention. This was like,
Yeah.
I thought it was a flare gun. I was like, God dang, that's bright. And especially when it's dark, there's no lights out there. I mean, there's a soccer field that's about maybe 150 yards out from where we were, but nothing like this. This was like in the middle of the woods. There's no light source there. There's nothing. It's supposed to be a nature trail. There's nothing there. No electricity whatsoever. So for that kind of blast of light for it to be there, that really like, am I talking aliens?
Yeah, I know the one that we saw here in 2020, in October of 2020. We live out in the boondocks of the desert in a little community, but we live pretty far away from the city, okay? And this thing just it had this brightness about it, like it was a flare, like it was like a white flare, intense white, and it did it zipping around. And like I say, I got the feeling like it was like a being or an entity was saying, "Hey, hi,
Hi, Steve.
hi, Steve. We know where
We
you
know who
are."
you are. We know you've moved.
I still have weird things happening to me, like like if I got out of my body the other night and I didn't realize I'd gotten out of my body. I had to go to the bathroom about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was in the bed, and and I'm a 250-pound guy, so I don't just jump out of bed like I did when I was 16. So I got out of bed, and just kind of jumped out of bed and went to the door to open it, and I couldn't open the door. And I was getting frustrated. Then I said, "Oh, I'm out of my body."
He
So what I
reached his
did,
body in bed.
so I turned around and I saw myself, my body still laying where it was. And I thought, "Oh my God, did I just die or something?" I said, "Oh no, you're just out of your body." So I went over there and I kind of touched my body a couple of times. And I said, "Okay, I better get back in." So I laid back in my body, and then I got up the usual way, which was a little slow, and
With
then
your
went
body,
back
yeah.
with my body. So it's a bit, see, I've had so many weird things happen. Like for instance, for years, for decades, I would have, as I was getting to sleep, I would just really starting to get really relaxed, and I'd always hear like this three knocks behind my head, like on the wall, like a knock, 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 a
Loud.
series of three, and it would just like wake me up. Or sometimes it would be a door slamming or a plate glass window being broken, just like it was right in the room. And it's just like it was just like this harassment
And they
that.
have his psychic connection with him at all times, we think, but they can't come through unless he's in a relaxed state, like a almost like an astral state. And the astral veil, as I said, comes down.
Where's
And then they're there. Like he's what was the entity with the black entity with the gold eyes last
oh,
time?
the m most recent one?
Yeah, this was very recent. He's still experiencing this a lot.
I mean, I haven't had it since that time, but it was I've experienced this entity on several different occasions. The most recent one, it was this large black being with these golden eyes that I woke in the bed, and it was just like standing there just watching me. And I said, "What do you want? What do you want from me? Tell me what you want." I'd rather have them just basically say, "Stephen, this is what we've been doing. We've been stealing your sperm for 5 decades, and you've got kids all over the world that are hybrids,
Yeah.
but don't play these games with me anymore. I just want to know what you really want from me." So.
Isaac, when I was first researching this stuff and finding out about the, not only are they abducting people and stealing their genetic material, they've got this bizarre hybrid alien breeding program going on where they take women, impregnate them, through sex most of the time. And then the 4 months later, they steal the fetus. And then years later, they introduce them to their
yes,
hybrid alien children. And I realized when I had to report on this for the book, and I thought, God, could it be any weirder that if I made it up myself? But this phenomenon has been documented again and again. And women are frequently all their children are just stolen away this way.
They've been able to verify this through obstetricians. That's, they say, you were pregnant. And as far as I can tell from the ultrasound, that you were never pregnant.
Right.
It's, I know that everything. I know that your fetus was 5 centimeters large, and they just, and sometimes they'll do it 2 or 3 or 4 times to a specific woman. And then sometimes occasionally they will be introduced to their star children.
Right.
Have bigger eyes and whatever. And it's almost always in a telepathic manner, where they don't actually speak to their kids, but it's like they're talking. And I think that's one of these latent abilities that human beings, we actually have. It's like if you never do a pull-up in your life, you'll never develop the muscle to do pull-ups, okay? You never get, get your latissimus dorsi, stimulated so that you can do pull-ups. If you never practice, telepathy, you'll probably never be able to do telepathy unless you're taught how to do it. And obviously, if you're taught, before the age of 5, it would probably be very simple.
And we think it's a human ability, but that it has atrophied in us, but not with them. They have kept it up. It's almost like it's not something you can you're just born with and do naturally. It's something you actually have to work at. You have to open the chakras. You have to open these abilities up. And we think that as a culture, that they may have been doing this all along. Remember, we lost our culture. We lost everything about ourselves except our lives. But they didn't. They kept their technology. And when we were first looking at the phenomenon, we tried to, going through this mountain of data, it seemed like, and the theories were that these beings are coming here from distant star systems, from all different places, the Pleiades and Orion and over here and over there.
Sirius.
But what we figured out, we believe, has happened here. In the old days, thousands of years ago, we were a primitive people, and they were playing God. They used to play God. They'd come in these pantheons of gods, conveniently able to mate with us, though, have a sex and have children with us. But they were playing gods, which would have been easy to do because they had this advanced technology. Now we think they're playing space alien. We think that they're actually disseminating information, false information, out into the ether of our consciousness. Linda Moulton Howe, for instance, she talked at the last time we were at Contact in the Desert last June. She spoke in detail about a meeting she had with a whistleblower who took her out on a boat and told her that we're actually part of a federation of all different planets, and that they come from the white, tall whites come from there, and the tall blues come from there, and the grays over there, and
reptiloids over here, and the felines over there, and the insectoids over there.
Right. So we don't think that's happening at all. We think that they are disseminating this fake information into our collective knowledge. One of the reasons we think it is supposedly two of these starships that we're traveling on with them
for the past 21 years
happen to be named after two members of the Majestic 12. So why these aliens from distant star systems supposedly are naming two of their starships after two generals from 1947, it makes obviously no sense. But if you wanted to disseminate information into the ufology community, Linda Moulton Howe is the person you leak it to, because she's like the first lady of the ufology community, where she's so famous that it would instantly, and of course this is exactly what she did. But we think that it's all a big fake, that they're just trying to keep us looking up
instead of looking down
under our feet.
Right.
And one of the things that I put in the book that I think is proof of this is the Valiant Thor testimony. Supposedly this alien lands a spaceship in Virginia in, I forget the exact date, but it was in the 50s.
Mid-50s.
And he, out comes a Caucasian red-haired man.
White man, yes.
Human being. And he was an advisor in the Pentagon for supposedly 3 years. And he claimed to come from Venus. And now we know, I mean, in the 40s, we didn't know this, but now we know that Venus is incapable of supporting a regular life like us. You know, I mean, maybe they can, it can, some, you know, impossibly tough bacteria live there, but nothing else. You know, they're, it's obviously a...
It's disinformation.
Right. We think it's a disinformation campaign that they are perpetrating, as they slowly infiltrate our society with their hybrid beings that they're breeding.
Yes. That's in a nutshell.
Well, I feel like I can talk to you guys for hours about this stuff. You guys are like unloading information. In the podcast world, we call this a day off where we don't have to continue the conversation. You guys fill it and with everything without with so much imprecision. But we could probably go for another hour or so. But all great information, all new ways of thinking about stuff, definitely. And I'm assuming majority of this is in your guys' book, correct?
Yes, and more, of course. We can't talk about the entire book in podcast.
Yeah, we scratched the surface.
Yes. Can I give us a shameless plug on our book again?
Well, yes, I was going to say, where can everyone find the book? And where can we find you guys?
It's called Who They Are and What They're Up To by Leslie and Stephen Shaw. It's available on Amazon and Ingram Books. And we also have an Instagram page that we're working on trying to disseminate Stephen's a lot of his family's stories. We've got like series of stories. And we're also collecting, if people have experiences, please share them with us at our handle on Instagram, which is Leslie.shaw.author. And Leslie is spelled Leslie.shaw.author. And our Facebook handle is the same. And we have a website at whotheyarebook.com where there's some book excerpts and blogs. And also we have, you know, the links to any podcasts that we do. We post them there too.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you guys coming on.
Thank you for having us, Isaac.
Thank you very much.
As always, catch your weirdos in the next one.